and Peter Grimmin is our tech commentator today. Good morning, Peter.
Morning, Catherine.
Let's start with Rocket Lab. It's one of those companies that's always talked about. You know, there's always about three or four companies it's always talked about as the big New Zealand tech successes. It's just gone to a different stratosphere, however, with the NASDAQ listing looming. Mm-hmm. And what's the backstory to this?
So Rocket Lab has been around for over 10 years now or longer. Peter Beck, the engineer who came up with the idea of these small rockets to get satellites into space. There's a whole new generation of very small satellites that are providing broadband and satellite imagery. So he specializes in small rockets, and he's carved out a real lucrative niche in the rocket industry doing that. So what he is now doing is taking Rocket Lab to the NASDAQ, which is the second biggest stock exchange in the world. All the high growth companies, the tech companies like the Google, Amazon, Tesla. So it's a very prestigious place to be. It's only the second company ever from New Zealand. New Zealand founded company, because technically Rocket Lab is now a US company, but the second New Zealand-founded company that will list on the NASDAQ. So that's a lot of cachet involved with that. It will value the company at around $6 billion New Zealand dollars. It will raise about $1 billion in capital for them. And they will use that capital to develop a bigger rocket called the Neutron, which will allow them to put bigger satellites and more satellites up into space. So these, they call them these clusters of satellites that are going to provide broadband coverage around the planet. They can put dozens and dozens of these things up at once. That's why they're going big now.
How big, physically big, are the rockets, broadly speaking? I mean, we sort of imagine ones that are travelling to space, but these are about propelling a, you know, an object into a certain place. What sort of scale are they?
The ones that they're putting up at the moment, some of them are very small. They call them sort of CubeSats. So universities and research institutions and military organisations as well are putting these small satellites. So this will allow, with Neutron, much bigger payload. They're talking about 8,000 kilograms. So you're talking about big satellites here, the size of a car potentially.
That changes
the game. It puts them also in a field of strong competitors as well. As they go bigger, they start to come across the likes of the SpaceX type companies that Elon Musk has founded. So this is them saying, we're not a small player, niche player anymore. We want to compete with the big boys.
So their relationship to the New Zealand now is what? It's a bit like, what's that amazing, LanzaTech, you know, amazing companies whose origins were here and are now heavily based overseas. What is the link back to New Zealand still?
Yeah, well, it's, you know, Peter Beck is still the CEO, and I think he will probably, for the next few years anyway, remain the CEO. He's just such a driving force in getting the Electron rocket. He'll probably see Neutron through. But then, of course, you know, he'll probably be made a billionaire out of this transaction. So we've seen people like Rod Drury at Xero then take a back seat, become a, you know, an executive director or something like that, and then go and do something else. So that may be in his future. But ultimately, they still manufacture the rockets in Auckland. They launch them at Mahia Peninsula.
Right.
They have a launch pad now in the US, which increasingly they'll be using. Hundreds of staff here in New Zealand. So it's one of those stories.
It's still quite strongly connected.
It is. And I've seen this over the years where companies like Navman was a classic one, making in-car satellite navigation units. Great New Zealand company. At one point, we're tipped to maybe go down the NASDAQ listing route. Instead, they were bought by another American-listed company, and within a few years, they were gone, pretty much. So I don't think that will happen with Rocket Lab, because they've built the talent base here in New Zealand, these engineers and designers.
He's a particular individual too, isn't he, Beck? You get the impression it's personal, you know? It's personal for Rod Drury, right? But like, you get the feeling it's that the connection and the energy is so direct that, you know, what might be the logical strategic move might be more difficult for him. I'm curious, the other company on the NASDAQ was Maas Technology, wasn't it? It was Marine Air Systems. It was Sir Neville Jordan, of course. That was way back in 75.
Well, 75 he founded the company. 97 he listed.
Yes.
And it was a short reign there, really. Within a year, he'd been acquired by another company, a California company, Digital Microwave Corporation. So it was a very short period of time that this New Zealand company with a CEO that was a Kiwi based in Lower Hutt was actually on the NASDAQ. And it was a very small amount of money for the time. But the legacy of that, the money that Neville Jordan extracted from listing the company and getting those shares, he put into Endeavour Capital, which over the last 25 years or so has invested in a lot of startups. So that's had a pretty good legacy. There's still a group of people, engineers in Lower Hutt, who are part of the successor company to MasTec that are still making microwave equipment here in New Zealand. So hopefully the legacy of that, the likes of Xero, which was the other one, Rod Drury did want to list on the NASDAQ. As far back as when he launched, he said that was his goal. When we reach $100 million, we'll be pushing for a NASDAQ listing. But they never really cracked the US market. They still haven't. Intuit is their big competitor, also NASDAQ listed, and they haven't been able to make inroads there. That's why they went to the ASX instead, which is where they're doing really well.
What are you wanting when you are heading NASDAQ? You're wanting a lot of cash, right? You're wanting a lot of capital. What else are you wanting when you're choosing how to raise that capital? You mention often there's a... and we've got this chronic problem, New Zealand companies getting to a certain size and then getting bought out. You can understand it. Person slogged away on their baby. They've got it to this size. Someone's offering them $25 million bucks even, right? And why wouldn't you?
Yeah.
But when it comes to those companies pushing on to list, what is it they're weighing up?
Yeah.
And why the NASDAQ?
Ultimately, it is capital. They want capital to grow, to invest in a new rocket. Sometimes there's an exit strategy as well, particularly if there's venture capital money in there. They see the IPO as an exit. So there's that motivation. But for New Zealand companies, I think the appeal is we're quite risk averse in this country. So there's not a huge amount of appetite to invest in risky things like Rocket Lab, which has a huge chance of success. But if the rockets crash, share price is going to plunge as well. So there's that. Liquidity is much better on the NASDAQ, so there's a lot more trading flows. You've got analysts there who are covering the space industry in great detail. All of this attracts this critical mass of people who are interested in high-growth companies.
So you make a much bigger buzz, effectively, don't you? You build a much bigger buzz around
and
your product.
And space tech at the moment, you've got Virgin Galactic, you've got SpaceX, you've got Leo Labs. There's this whole cluster of companies really around the NASDAQ that are taking off.
What I like about what you've just described to me, though, is that we're not talking about yet another let's, shoot a toy into space and put a suit on and be the first person to fly around Pluto. Sorry to be slightly cynical, but I'd like people to put their efforts into resolving climate change before we worry about flying around Pluto. Is Pluto still a planet? I think they dropped it. That's even more reason to go. But what I like about it's practical, it's useful stuff, and it's solving purposes. It's not just about that kind of ego race we see between the Musks and the who's the Amazon guy, Bezos
with Blue Origin.
We're talking about, yes, it is new tech and it's high tech and it's literally going into space, but it's to deliver things that can be useful.
Yeah, Beckett's always said he's more interested in what's happening on Earth than going to Mars. Although, this new one will be able to launch equipment to the moon and to Mars. So I think he's seeing the business opportunity there. But fundamentally, this is a high risk business.
Sure.
And he's talking about having revenue of $1 billion US by 2026. I think last year it was around $90 million. So that's what the NASDAQ investors love, these high-growth, high-ambition companies. But it is fraught with risk.
Well, that's the nature of entrepreneurship at that level, isn't it? It really is. Okay, now staying with big tech companies, I'm really interested in your take on how the Facebook Australian government scrap wrapped up. We've had some commentary, including from our own media commentator, that it kind of got resolved. The media companies got some money. The government got out of the crisis of having all its websites taken down by Facebook. Facebook backtracked. It just feels like a puny amount of money, to me personally. A puny amount of money paid to some companies, and now everyone else is going to have to go cap in hand and try and find someone to pick up the phone or the equivalent at Facebook if they want to negotiate their cut. And it's also set a global precedent. Are you of the same mind that actually there's one winner out of this ultimately, and it was Facebook?
Absolutely. I think Facebook, this was a genius move to pull the plug on news websites. And it was a mistake that they included some government websites there. They didn't mean to do that. That was a screw up on their part. But that showed that they're willing to walk away from the news business in Australia, which is only 4% of their traffic. I've talked to lots of experts who agree that news doesn't matter that much for Facebook, except in one area. They're under the gun at the moment because of the way they handle the spread of misinformation on their website.
It's quite a big area.
It's a big area, and that will lead to regulation if they're not careful. So by not having news on there, they've got a bigger problem on their hand. People can't link to an ABC news article and say, well, look, here's the real deal about vaccination. So I think that was a weakness for them. But ultimately what they've got...
Doesn't that, though, sorry to interrupt you, doesn't that raise the price and the value of news to that platform then? Not only that it drove traffic, for a time anyway, drove a lot of traffic and brought them a lot of customers, but now as that might fade, it's giving them a credibility and a defence against regulation. Doesn't that raise even further the value of that free stuff it posts?
Absolutely. And while it's 4% of all posts on the network, I think it has a disproportionate value,
exactly,
which is why ultimately they've come back and are willing to cut these deals. But ultimately, this news bargaining code started out with a lot of teeth in it, a very strong piece of legislation that meant if Facebook couldn't reach commercial terms with all of these Australian publishers, ABC, Channel 9, the Australian News Corp, the government would step in and arbitrate and basically say, this is going to be the price you're paying those media outlets. That's why Facebook said, we will not live with that. We're walking away. They managed to get changes to the code that took out that proviso. So they will do commercial deals now. They can walk away at any point. And it will be very unlikely that any of these negotiations actually go to arbitration now.
Well, you know, what's an indie going to do when this stuff's being used? You know, what are they going to, how do you even contact Facebook?
Yeah.
You know? So a new entrant's going to have to go cap in hand and say, you're using my stuff, would you please pay for it?
Yeah, and they'll enter commercial negotiations. And if Facebook wants to enter commercial negotiations, they don't have to, and they can walk away at any time. So, you know, the credit to the Australian government that without them pushing this really quite strong legislation initially, we probably wouldn't have seen this escalate to a solution. Facebook would have just carried on not paying lip service to news, not really supporting them to any degree. So maybe a few million dollars are going to go to some of those bigger outlets in Australia, which is fine as long as they put that back into increasing their coverage, because there's no obligation for them to do that in the legislation. They'll get some more money, but it doesn't structurally change the fundamental problem, which is that Google and Facebook control the digital ad market in Australia, and it's just getting more and more concentrated.
Including government spending. What am I reading here from, this is your article in The Listener. Of the $110 million the New Zealand government spent on advertising in 2018-19, 30% went to Facebook and Google. That was before COVID.
Yeah.
And again, it's damned if you do, damned if you don't, as we talk about how do you reach people where they are.
Yeah.
Which brings us back to why you need regulation. And does this set a precedent? I want to come back to Google, but for Facebook, does this set a precedent that now the EU is going to have to deal with?
Yeah, I think the EU has passed copyright legislation. France has already forced Google to negotiate there. The other EU countries will as well. So these deals will be done all over the world. But you know, the experts, you know, I talked to about this from my piece in the Listener, are saying here in New Zealand, without any sort of firm hand from the government in terms of some sort of code or regulation, there's no incentive for them to cut deals here. So we'll be last off the rank in terms of getting these deals for our own media companies.
What about Google? Does it have a bigger issue than Facebook did with media and search?
Yeah.
Well, search is slightly different again, but with media and its use of media content.
Yeah, Google has a much greater incentive to do deals, because what they were facing was if they couldn't come to commercial terms, they were going to have to remove news from their search engine results, which is a disaster. That breaks the fundamental philosophy behind Google search, which is all the world's information indexed in one place. If you take out all the news articles, which are usually listed at the top of those search results, that's a really poor user experience. So they caved relatively quickly, and it's hard to know, this will hopefully come out in the coming months, the role that News Corp had in leading the charge on applying pressure, both on the Australian government, but also on Google executives to come to that deal. So big deals have been done between News Corp and Google and other Australian companies, and Google is doing those deals all over the world now. So this is the norm now, that they've put aside $1 billion to pay media companies. So that is progress, I guess.
No, I hear $1 billion. What percentage is that even of their revenue?
Yeah, it's tiny. It's tiny. And
of the cost of producing global media output,
yeah,
it's tiny.
Yeah.
Okay. So where does this leave New Zealand, by the way? Implications of what's just happened in Oz?
Well, yeah, I think, and a lot of people are quite frustrated at just how little we've done in this country around studying the digital economy here and where there are problems with it. The Commerce Commission's done nothing like the ACCC, no sort of even research into what the situation is here. The only bit they did was around the NZME Stuff merger, and some interesting stuff came out of that. But Chris Farfoy is basically saying he's got Ministry of Culture and Heritage doing some research itself. He's interested in Facebook and Google doing commercial deals here in New Zealand, but without any trigger for negotiations to ramp up and escalate. I just don't see what transpired in Australia happening here. But on the other hand, Farfoy has just announced a few weeks ago $55 million to go to media companies. So they're taking...
It's taxpayer funds. I do think we often miss the boat to hook up quicker with Australia on stuff that is essentially parallel to us.
Absolutely.
It just gives us a bit more heft.
Yeah.
And yes, we have to sweat and take the heat as well, but you do if you want the benefits. This would have seemed a prime example where a step change against the biggest players in the globe, who could not give a damn about us, frankly, they've shown that multiple times, we could have got a foot in the door at the same time.
Huge lost opportunity. If our Commerce Commission bodies had coordinated that research that started 3 years ago in Australia, they'd have a good basis from which to launch some legislation. They've missed the boat on that. The one redeeming factor might be the path that they seem to be going down here in New Zealand, which is rather than get the companies to do these commercial deals, force them to the table, let's make the tax base more equitable. So they're talking about Grant Robertson. If there is no global deal on making multinationals pay fair amount of tax in New Zealand, maybe they will start to do a unilateral sort of deal on that and force them. So maybe if they take some of that tax revenue and put it into this fund for the media on an ongoing basis, maybe that's a better way of doing it.
Okay, now Microsoft Mesh is what? Sounds
science fiction at the moment.
Oh, okay.
But they just, at their Ignite conference yesterday, they just unveiled this, which is a new form of video conferencing, which everyone is totally over at the moment, Teams meetings and Zoom meetings. But they all involve a screen, which is a limiting factor. What Mesh is what they call mixed reality. You put on a headset, a HoloLens set, you stand in a room and you see everyone else around you in that meeting as, you know, Princess Leia type apparitions walking around you, as the Star Wars movie.
So it's like being sitting in a room.
Yeah, that's right. So you've got the environment around you. It's a much more naturalistic way to have a meeting. Initially, it will be an avatar that represents you, but eventually the technology will be your actual physical presence in real time.
Nauseous, not just from the meeting.
Well, that is the problem.
That's an issue, isn't it?
Yeah. Virtual reality has really not taken off, and that's the key problem, is it's not a comfortable experience.
Our inner ear and our brains are struggling with it,
And the other problem holding this back at the moment, I think, will be the HoloLens is a very expensive device, so it needs to be successful on the cheaper headsets, a $200 headset rather than a $2,000 headset.
Plus, how will you surf Facebook on your phone in your Zoom meeting if everyone's at the table with you?
And they're all seeing you do it. Bit of a flaw.
It'll ruin it all. Thanks so much, Peter Griffin.